Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
it. Coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Maron to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Maron at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Welcome again to the Explaining History podcast, and tonight we're going to be looking at the Great Terror of the late 1930s, 1937 onwards, and trying to kind of get a sense of what it is ordinary Russian people, ordinary Soviet citizens must have been able to make of these events around them. All too often when we look at state terror, we fail to recognise the importance of this bottom-up dimension. Once again, we're looking at the works of Sheila Fitzpatrick tonight in Everyday Stalinism, the book which we've referred to probably the most when looking at the history of the Soviet Union in the 1920s and 30s. We're trying to get that sense of how ordinary Soviet citizens either navigated this period of time or tried to make some form of sense of it. Often there was a kind of a process of understanding change or imminent change in the Soviet Union. Often one would look at writings, letters and articles by Stalin that appeared in newspapers. Some Soviet citizens believe that they were adept at interpreting the nuance of these letters and trying to kind of decipher what it is what it is Stalin was saying, and would try sometimes to kind of predict on the basis of Stalin's writings what direction policy was going in. Sheila Fitzpatrick writes, "By the beginning of 1937, both educated and uneducated Russians were seeing signs that a time of national misfortune was at hand. The most important proximate cause for this perception was the failure of the 1936 harvest, which in the following winter and spring led to hunger in the countryside, bread lines in the towns, and a panicky fear that things would get still worse, as in 1932 to 33. In the countryside, rumours of imminent famine, turmoil and war flew around, as they had during collectivisation." So the kind of the great crisis period that had preceded the Great Terror was obviously collectivisation, the famine that followed it, and the anti-Kulak campaigns. And there was, I mean, it's entirely reasonable for many Soviet citizens to look at food shortages and see some great calamity coming, not just hunger, but some great upheaval and turmoil based around the ever-problematic food supplies in the Soviet Union. Of course, the terror and bloodshed of the collectivization and the Great Famine era was in large part about a kind of a mass theft of foodstuffs from the peasantry to transfer it to the urban proletariat and to use as a kind of as export commodities to industrialize Russia rapidly. And it was just adjudicated by Stalin and his inner circle that the peasants were the easiest ones to victimise. Sheila Fitzpatrick writes, "There were other contributing factors. Since the beginning of the first five-year plan and collectivisation, the regime and society had been under constant stress, strained to the utmost by the industrialisation drive, the disaster of collectivisation, the apprehension about the international situation that had put the country on a pre-mobilisation footing. Within the Communist Party, the atmosphere became increasingly tense as the process of small p purging begun in 1933-34 was repeated in 1935 and again in 1936. After Kirov's murder, former oppositionists became targets of terror, and Zinoviev and Kamenev were tried twice and in 1936 executed for alleged responsibility." The murder of Kirov is an event in Soviet history, also in the kind of Soviet social history of the 1930s, akin to the assassination of John F. Kennedy in 1963, in terms of the shock that it had on many ordinary Soviet citizens. Kirov, the Leningrad Party boss, very popular politician, very charismatic politician, very well-known politician, and the effect of his assassination shouldn't be understated, really. It places a huge degree of crisis, or a sense of crisis, and also of national mourning into the lives of a huge section of the Soviet populace. The attempt to associate Stalin's opposition, or the former oppositionists to Stalin, with the assassination, to some seems absurd. To a great many, it works. The fact that the trials that Kamenev and Zinoviev are put on are public, are mass media spectacles. And it works not just on Soviet citizens, but on foreign onlookers. If you read the diaries of Sidney and Beatrice Webb, they look at the trial of Zinoviev and think, well, he must have done something. There's no way Stalin would be doing this if there wasn't some sort of rationale. Now, perhaps Sidney and Beatrice Webb and their kind of overall naivety about the Soviet Union aren't the best people to evaluate. But time and again, in the fellow traveller movement, the left intellectuals and liberal intellectuals who were drawn to the Soviet Union because of its successes in the five-year plans, time and again, they look at the terror and think, a number of things, I think. Firstly, this must be in some way justified because Stalin wouldn't be doing otherwise. They also think, well, didn't France have its terror and come through that and become a mature republic? And isn't Russia that sort of country where, you know, and this is a deeply colonial attitude in a way, isn't Russia that sort of country where you have to do this kind of thing from time to time because they're sort of barbarians, really? And there's no other way that you're going to turn this backward country into a modern power without, you know, firing squads. So it'll all come out in the wash, you know. You have to break a few eggs to make an omelette. And this is probably unpleasant, but for the best. And also the people who are, you know, Cameron Evans and Aviev and later Bukharin, they've all probably done something. And of course the terror begins as a purge of the party, just as kind of Mao recreates this later on during the Cultural Revolution. The terror is aimed at party members initially, and it begins with expulsions, but later it radicalizes itself and becomes more about mass arrests and then trials and execution. All of the executions are done essentially legally. They are in line with Soviet law. These aren't extrajudicial killings. There are trials and sentences, and the sentences are penned into the Stalin Constitution, 1936. Sheila Fitzpatrick writes, almost 9% of those expelled in the most recent party purge, a total of 15,000, had been arrested as spies, kulaks, white guards, and scoundrels of various kinds, Yezhov told the Central Committee in December 1935, and there would have to be more arrests. As one speaker at the meeting put it, as soon as those expelled from the party get home, they start getting involved in counter-revolutionary activity, they should be smoked out before the real trouble begins. Now, this is fascinating dialogue, and it speaks volumes. Firstly, let's look at the numbers. 9% of those expelled from the party have been arrested as spies. It was 15,000 people. So we're not talking about the top brass of the party. This goes down to regional and local party bosses and functionaries and bureaucrats. This is a kind of a purge of many different strata of the party. And the idea that they've been arrested as spies, kulaks and white guards, these are the kinds of people, or the suspect enemy classes, who Stalin feared, if you didn't deal with them, would be there when an enemy power crossed the border. These are the kinds of people who you get rid of. Otherwise, basically, you've got a big, big problem on your hands. You've got the problem of a fifth column, an army of traitors in your midst that will rise up when perhaps Hitler or maybe another foreign power invades. And a lot of the explanation for the terror is this process that Stephen Kotkin, in his second volume of the Stalin biography, calls Waiting for Hitler. That you have to get this country ready for the inevitable war, and by killing off those who would help the enemy, then you're doing the most effective thing. You're actually kind of waging the war before the first shot has been fired. There's this concept again that, you know, if once these people go home, they're going to start engaging in the real counter-revolutionary activity. You've got to smoke them out. Quite what it was these enemies, in inverted commas, would be doing is never ever really made clear. They'll be doing something or other, communicating with one another secretly. Perhaps they know about stockpiles of weapons somewhere. All of this is in the realms of the imagination. But there is this kind of theme, and I've referred to it many, many times before on this podcast, about there being a public face. The Bolshevik idea of individuals having a public face and a private face, and the public face often being a mask. And in order to find out what lies behind the mask, you know, when the mask is dropped, what the truth really is, one needs to kind of go to some great, great lengths and start.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Essentially, the Kulaks particularly are very good at pretending that they're now cooperating, pretending to be Soviet citizens. But what is in their heart? What is really motivating them? Are they really loyal to the revolution? Are they really loyal to the Soviet state? And I suppose revolutions create this kind of sentiment of hyper-loyalism and hyper-vigilance. You can never really truly know whether somebody is of the true faith or not. Sheila Fitzpatrick writes, "The pool of ex-communist members grew until by early 1937, worried party leaders were pointing out that in some regions and enterprises, the numbers of ex-communists equaled or exceeded the number of current party members. These people, it was assumed, were enemies, part of that inexorably expanding group that included not only everyone who had ever opposed the regime, but also everyone who the regime had ever injured, not to mention the entire capitalist world whose hostile encirclement threatened the survival of the Soviet state. Soviet political culture had developed no effective mechanisms for allowing errant sheep back into the fold. The needs for such mechanisms were recognised, also one might conclude from actions like the party's readmission of former oppositionists, the return of civil rights to deported kulaks, and the attempt to destigmatise social aliens in the 1936 constitution. But these efforts rarely succeeded for long. Deportees remained tied to their places of exile, former disenfranchised persons were still objects of discrimination regardless of the constitution, and almost all former oppositionists were again expelled and arrested as enemies of the people. Within a few years of their readmission, stigma was essentially permanent. Black marks on the record could not be expunged." And again, these black marks that can't be expunged, these explain a lot about the radicalisation of the terror. The Soviet Union is an immensely, it's a kind of bureaucratic dictatorship that works on card indexes and names and lists and files. If you find an individual who has been guilty of being a class enemy, a kulak, they can't shake this other than adopting a new identity, which is a very risky thing to do. They can't shake this because it's written down. There's no way of hiding your class origins. There's no way of hiding the fact that you've been in the Gulag. And in 1937 and 1938, when the state requires the purges to be done by quota, when NKVD bosses across the country are told, in order to show your loyalty to the boss, to Stalin, you need to be hitting targets of criminals apprehended. And if you're not doing that, then we have to raise serious questions about your zeal. well, what does one NKVD officer do? You go back through the files. You need to find people. So you find people in your area who have been accused of being white guards or kulaks or whatever, and you bring them in and interrogate them prosecute them, and event or very quickly, when it comes to the three-man troikas, decide just on names on lists who's to be shot. Sometimes, when kulaks have been sent to the camps, the NKVD would go and fish them out of the camp for re-interrogation and re-prosecution and then summary execution. Or kulaks who were leaving the camps were rearrested when they left. And it's because this is a numbers game, and the theory that Yezhov and later Beria subscribed to was that if you did the numbers, you'd get the guilty people eventually, and it's better to shoot 100 innocent people and get one guilty one than let the guilty man get away. That the guilty man getting away is too dangerous. On the subject of the kulaks, added suspicion came their way by the fact that they had initially, or many had initially, fled the countryside to begin with. This, in the eyes of a kind of a super suspicious state, was the action of a spy, Sheila Fitzpatrick writes. Worse from the communist standpoint was the fact that many of these enemies, victims of the regime, regime's punishment and stigmatization, were no longer readily identifiable because they had masked themselves. Kulaks and their children had fled to towns and become workers, hiding their former identities. Former nobles had changed their names and taken on work as humble accountants. Former priests and priests' children had moved to other parts of the country and become teachers. Persons expelled from big cities at the time of passportization had come back with forged passports and were posing as respectable citizens. Even communists expelled from the party for various derelictions had re-entered the party with forged cards. Was it not likely that within this huge community of the disaffected, networks and conspiracies would grow? Was not this a new class of enemies, mutually linked, like the old privileged classes, by invisible bonds of sympathy and shared grievances? The suspicion and conspiratorial mentality that had always characterised the Soviet Communist Party had not declined, as might have been expected as the Revolutionary Party consolidated power. The failure of collectivization and the shock of Kirov's murder had seen to that. So here we see that the terror represents an immense insecurity on the part of the party. This is a party that has not answered very many material needs of the Soviet people. There has been forced industrialization, but during that time, there's been hunger. During that time, there's been housing shortages. During that time, there has been the problems associated with rapid urbanization. During that time, for example, crime in the Soviet Union is still a significant problem. There are very lawless towns and cities that party officials don't like to go to because they're too dangerous. And so you have a party that is acutely aware that it hasn't managed to address the needs of the people, and that it has had the disaster of collectivization along the way. And just as Stalin in 1934 at the Congress of the Victors feels and very kind of insecure about his position, so there is a kind of a conspiratorial and a paranoid mentality across the whole party of people wondering perhaps there could be an opposite, you know, a secret oppositional organization develop against us. Because, you know, on some level we deserve it, or it would at least be understandable if this did emerge because of the party's failings. And the centralization of decision making, the destruction of independent centers of power within the party, and the ending under Lenin of internal party debate, which is obviously magnified under Stalin, means that the party is not the kind of robust structure that other political parties are, where debate, internal debate, can be entertained by the leadership, can be ameliorated, policies can shift. The party's rigidity is one of the things that makes terror necessary, because the leadership of the party are incapable of any form of compromise or any form of discussion because of centralisation. It is assumed by the leadership that oppositional views will meet in secret, will meet in private, will meet as conspiratorial factions. The extent to which this is happening was actually quite doubtful. But that was really, really immaterial at the time. Sheila Fitzpatrick writes, "This produced its own problems. If everyone claimed to agree, how could one know what they were all really thinking? Party membership must be reviewed yet again. Denunciation encouraged, surveillance increased. The party had always required its members to be vigilant, but now there was a difference. They should be vigilant not only against the enemies without, but also the enemies within. Within meant, in the first instance, inside the Communist Party. But there was also a hint of something even more disturbing, the possibility that the enemy might lie within oneself. Each man feels that somewhere in the depth of his soul is a little kernel of wrecking," writes a student of Stalinist culture. The diarist Stepan Podlubnyi, a son of a dekulakized peasant, knew this feeling of self-distrust and struggled to erase the tainted birthmark his origins had imprinted on him. As the party's collective self-examination continued, becoming ever more hysterical, certainties dissolved. It was possible, evidently, to be a wrecker without meaning to be one or ever knowing it. It was possible to wear a mask that deceived even oneself. So there we have it. The culture of the Soviet Union that required citizens to go through immense self-examination to make sure that the stains of kind of bourgeois thinking, of counter-revolutionary thinking, were expunged from the mind, caused citizens to often agonise over whether this was even ever possible entirely, and certainly encouraged them to observe one another. And the infrastructure for terror existed long before the state, the Great Terror, because of a culture of denunciation and suspicion, and tip-offs to the Soviet authorities. Most of the arrests that come during the Great Terror are as a result of either card indexes looking up people who might have slipped through the net a long time ago, or they are simply neighbourly and workplace denunciations. Anyway, thanks very much. I'll catch you on our next Explaining History podcast. Do come and check us out at the Explaining History Facebook group. Remember to subscribe to this podcast and you can get your weekly diet of Explaining History content coming straight to you. And check us out at www.explaininghistory.org. Thanks very much, everybody. All the best. Bye-bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.